Yeah, I'm very pleased that I convinced John Schwartz to come give a historical and personal talk. It would all be from his own personal perspective. I think that most of you know that John is one of the founders of string theory, and his persistence and pioneering work when the subject was far from fashionable earned the admiration of many of us. And personally, I admire John, not only for his physics, but also for his various human qualities. Perhaps I may be allowed to recall that I first met John when I was a graduate student attending a Boulder summer school. And 30 years later, I don't remember anything about the school, except that John was very nice to me and invited me on a two-man camping trip. So here I have John.
Thanks, Tony. This is not a talk I've given before, and it was Tony's suggestion that I do it. I'm not sure how well it'll work. One reason I accepted is that in the past year, I've given a few talks that are related to this, which have been written up in three different preprints. And the first one is a half-hour talk I gave at a meeting in Paris, which was partly dedicated to Joelle Schurk, and there I spoke about work I had done in collaboration with Joelle. And the second paper here is the write-up of the talk I gave for Lenny Susskind's 60th birthday, and on that occasion I focused on the early history of string theory, emphasizing the topics that Lenny contributed to. And in the third paper is the write-up of a short talk I gave at a meeting in Minnesota last October, which was entitled 30 Years of Supersymmetry. And my contribution was to recall how supersymmetry arose in string theory in the early days. So in any case, in this talk, I'm going to try to give you a brief overview of the period from 1960 to 1985 at a rate of about 2 minutes per year, which I figure is a factor of 250,000. And so I'm not going to make lots of disclaimers, but in any case, I make no pretense of balance, fairness, or objectivity. That's my disclaimer. So I've divided this period into six sub-periods, and the first one I've called the analytic S matrix, and I will tell you about activities that were going on mostly in Berkeley during that era. Then 68 to 70 is when the what was called the dual resonance model was first formulated. This was later interpreted as being string theory, but in this period we didn't even know we were doing string theory. We were doing string theory for 2 years before we knew it. And then I'll tell you about the second dual resonance model, which accommodates fermions, which is based on the work of Pierre Raymond and André Neveu and myself. Then I'll describe how we shifted from trying to describe hadron physics to describing gravity in unification. Discuss a little bit about supersymmetry and supergravity, and then describe the work I did mostly in collaboration with Michael Green during the first half of the 80s. And then we'll make a couple concluding comments. Please feel free to interrupt with any questions, comments, criticisms. This won't be a difficult talk. There'll be a little bit of physics in it, but won't be shouldn't be too hard to follow. So in 1960 to 68, the goal of a large fraction of the theoretical physics community, of the particle physics community, was to develop a theory of the hadrons. This was before the currently accepted theory, which is QCD, existed. The idea of quarks was introduced around 62 by Gell-Mann, but the idea that that could be the basis of some field theory of hadrons didn't yet exist. It seemed to me at the time that UC Berkeley was the center of the universe, And the intellectual leaders there in this work were Jeffrey Chu and Stanley Mandelstam, and the assistant professors were Steven Weinberg and Shelley Glashow, each of whom I took courses from my first year as a graduate student. So I was a graduate student there from 62 to 66, right in the middle of this period, and so was David Grouse. In fact, three of those 4 years we even shared an office. Now, the general principles that were espoused by Chu and his followers was that the Holy Grail is the S matrix on-shell scattering amplitudes, and that the attempt to describe off-shell physics, as you do in conventional quantum field theory, was, in his view, misguided. In fact, it was even stressed that to learn field theory would probably be harmful to you, and we were dissuaded from doing this. So that was the environment. Jeff, you don't hear a lot about Chu these days, which I think is unfortunate, because he, I think, in my opinion, made very important contributions. But for those of you who are young and don't know much about him, he really was regarded as the intellectual leader of theoretical physics, along with a few other people like Gell-Mann and so on. At big conferences, he would give summary lectures and so on and so forth. And anyway, so the principles, besides focusing on the S matrix, was that what you needed to do was to determine the S matrix, and that could be done if you incorporated certain general principles. And these principles were unitarity, various sorts of analyticity. And then a more detailed idea was what was crossing symmetry, that's related, Lorentz invariance. Another principle was what was called the bootstrap conjecture. And the idea was that when you consider a scattering amplitudes of hadrons, there are forces generated by the exchanges of hadrons, and that these forces provide the binding that's required to make the hadrons stick together. So the same particles are being formed as bound states through their own exchange. So that was the bootstrap idea. And the idea was that it was some big self-consistent system, and maybe to some extent it might even be unique. Another principle that arose following work of Tullio Regge was analyticity in angular momentum. Angular momentum, of course, is discrete, but if you impose suitable asymptotic conditions, then you can define a unique analytic continuation off of the integers. So the idea was that an analytically continued amplitudes in angular momentum would have poles at integer values of angular momentum corresponding to physical particles. So particles would lie on what were called Regge trajectories, which were the positions. So you have amplitudes, which are functions of angular momentum and mass squared, or energy, the invariant energy, and the poles would lie on what were observed to be roughly straight lines. There was lots of hadron resonances being discovered by experimentalists, and people plotted their angular momentum versus mass squared and saw that they relied on roughly straight lines, and that these lines almost always had slope, which was just about 1 GeV to the minus 2. One could argue that these trajectories not only accounted for the poles, but the trajectory down in this region was relevant also for controlling the high energy behavior of scanning amplitudes, which behaved in this way. So an idea that was related to the bootstrap idea was the duality idea. The fact that these trajectories were quite straight suggested that the widths of these resonances were quite small compared to their masses, and therefore a good approximation was what was called a narrow resonance approximation, which meant that you just focused on the single particle states and neglected multi-particle states. And in that kind of an approximation, you could formulate what was called a duality hypothesis, which was that if in a tree approximation, that the exchange of particles in one channel would be dual to exchanges of particles in the cross channel, and when you included all of them, you would be able to formulate an amplitude either way. this was very much at variance with conventional quantum field theory, where you would have Feynman diagrams of both kinds, which would be added. And here the idea was that if you included both, you'd be somehow double counting. Then people, to describe how quantum numbers would be built in, drew pictures like this, which were called duality diagrams. Harari, Rosner were some of the names associated with this. And so the idea is that the green lines represent the flow of quark-like quantum numbers, so that all the particles here would have quark, anti-quark quantum numbers. And this picture would show you how the quantum numbers flowed. And in finding these poles, X and Y, you could just see what the quantum numbers would be by looking at what kinds of quark lines you would be cutting if you cut the diagram in one way or the other. Of course, in string theory, we have pictures that look rather like this, which implement these ideas. And in the string theory picture, this would be a world sheet. And the interior would be filled in as a surface. And these green lines would be the boundary of the world sheet, where these quark-like quantum numbers would flow. Now we identify those quantum numbers as having something to do with D-brains. No D-brains back then. So in 1968, Veneziano wrote down this celebrated formula, which implemented some of these general principles with an explicit example. And it's just the Euler beta function, which is some ratio of gamma functions. And so he observed that if you take this ratio of gamma functions and take the Regge trajectory, alpha of s, to be a straight line, which, as I showed you, was a good approximation to experimental data, that this amplitude did satisfy the duality properties that I described on the previous transparency. And if you put in suitable coefficients in front of these different terms, you could take account of these quark quantum numbers. I didn't bother doing that here, but that can be added in. So this formula gave an explicit realization of duality and Regge behavior in this narrow resonance approximation. And I'm quite convinced that when Veneziano wrote down this formula, his motivation was phenomenological, that he wanted an example of a function that would be a good approximation to describing the hadron data, and that could be used for phenomenology. The amazing thing is that this turned out to be part of a real theory, and not just some wild phenomenology. Very soon after Veneziano wrote down that formula, Vera Zuro, who's now the director of the ICTP in Trieste, wrote down another formula. He said, here's another formula that has many of the same properties, the Regge behavior and the duality and so on. But it has total symmetry in the three Mandelstam invariants, S, T, and U. But it had similar virtues to Veneziano's formula. And he just plucked this out of the blue also, just like Veneziano did. And the amazing thing is that Veneziano's formula turned out to be a first approximation to scattering of open strings, strings with ends, and this turned out to be the first approximation to scattering of closed strings, strings that are loops. And so these just functions were just guessed out of the blue. Well, within a year after these formulas had been written down by these people, various people, I won't give you all the names, but several different groups, more or less simultaneously, wrote down n-particle generalizations of these formulas. So for the case of the open strings, namely the Veneziano amplitude, this was an n-particle generalization. So you integrate over some real variables, y with some measure that I haven't written down. The k's are the four momenta. We thought we were in four dimensions. The four momenta of the external lines. And the alpha prime is the slope of this universal slope of the Regge trajectories. So if there are just four external particles, if capital N is four, then this is the Veneziano formula. And then this formula, it turns out, has cyclic symmetry in the n external lines. It's not completely obvious as I've written it, but that can be proved. And then Joel Shapiro wrote down a similar generalization of the Vera Zuro formula, which was very similar, except it involved complex integrations rather than real integrations. Nowadays, we understand why this is real and this is complex. These are real because they represent integrations around the boundary of a world sheet, And these are complex because they represent integrations over the interior of a world sheet. But these four, nobody knew all that when these things were written down. So again, in the year 1969, several different groups, especially I would say Fubini and Veneziano, but also Bardacci, Mandelstam, and various others, showed that these formulas had a consistency, that you could take any one of them and factorize on the poles, and the residues would be, I mean, if you took the residue of a pole, it would factorize into a factor on either side of the line associated with that pole, and giving residue factors which had formulas of the same type. So there was an internal consistency on a well-defined spectrum of single particle states. And so these formulas could be viewed as the tree approximation to some sort of theory, and the spectrum was well-defined by these amplitudes and could be described by an infinite set of harmonic oscillators. So in the open string case, you'd have one set of oscillators where mu is a Lorentz index. I'm being general here and allowing d dimensions, but in those days, d was 4. And then m was just an integer, a positive integer. And in the case of the closed string amplitudes, the Shapiro-Virasoro amplitudes, there'd be two sets of these oscillators. These gave a conventional harmonic oscillator Fock space, except that the time component gave negative norm states. That was required just by Lorentz invariants. And so various trickery was developed for dealing with that by Virasoro in particular, who formulated certain subsidiary conditions that would decouple the negative norm states. Well, eventually, around 1970, these formulas were interpreted as describing the scattering of modes of a relativistic string. And I believe this discovery was made independently by three different people. First was probably Nambu. Second, I think, was Lenny Susskind. And third was Holger Nielsen. But they did it independently. But I find it remarkable that all the formulas preceded the interpretation. Pardon?
Much later.
I'm sorry?
And the verification of that general idea
came 2 years later. Right. So anyway, having found the factorization on single particle states, it became possible to study radiative corrections, or loop amplitudes. And so in 1970, or even in late 69 already, Kikawa, Sakita, and Virasoro made a first attempt at computing one loop amplitudes. They didn't do it quite right. They didn't know all the relevant facts yet. And the subject sort of took off in 1970. I was at Princeton and working on this problem. I did it in collaboration with David Gross, Andre Neveu, Joel Scherk, all of whom were in Princeton at the time. And the four of us wrote a few papers together studying one-loop amplitudes. One of the things we found, and it was also found by Susskind and his collaborators, was that if you looked at a certain four-particle one-loop amplitude for open strings, which we called a non-planar amplitude, that it had new and unexpected singularities. So the kind of picture we drew in those days was this, and we call this a twisted line. But the way to interpret this picture is to think of the lines as fat ribbons. And then this is twisting the ribbon. And then you can see that what this is, if you think of the two-dimensional surface, it's really a surface where you have a cylinder, and then two of the external lines are attached to one boundary of the cylinder, and the other two lines are attached to the other boundary of the cylinder. So that isn't the way we thought about it at the time. But giving it that interpretation makes clear what these new surprising singularities were. They were states which you got by cutting across the cylinder where you're seeing closed string intermediate states. So the two open strings join and give a closed string. And so these new singularities, however, we were working in four dimensions, because after all, we were doing hadron physics, why would I work in four dimensions? And we were finding branch points. We weren't finding poles that could be interpreted as closed string states. They seem, and therefore we were concerned that these violated the unitarity of the theory. And so we kind of left it at that as a puzzle. And soon thereafter, Claude Lovelace pointed out that these branch points would be poles if we had allowed the intercept of the leading Regit trajectory to be 1, as Virasoro had already taught us it should be to decouple negative norm states, and if we allowed the space-time dimension to be 26. This was really bizarre, because we were not thinking that way. And so that was kind of a bolt out of the blue.
What was the reaction to 26 at the time?
Well, the mathematics was undeniable. We didn't really know what to make of it, though.
The reaction, I think, really was that this is only a simple model. Make it more interesting, more complicated, include fermions and other quantum numbers. D will go down to 4.
It didn't go down to 10.
That's right. Well, that's that's what I'm about to discuss. Right. So in 1971, I started a collaboration with André Neveu. We were still in Princeton. And let me first tell you what Pierre Ramond did before I tell you what André and I did. So Pierre Ramond was at Yale, I believe, at the time, pretty much by himself, so to speak, at least as far as this kind of work was concerned. And Pierre's idea was to look for a stringy analog of the Dirac equation. So he noticed that for the string theory I was just telling you about, you could define the momentum of the string, which was given by some integral of a momentum density.
Did he use that word, the string?
No, he didn't. But you'll find these formulas, though.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if he knew that these were strings at that point. Because even though the fact existed already, well, when he wrote his paper, which was January of 71, certainly that was later than this Nambu-Susskind work I was mentioning. But that work, with that interpretation by Nambu and Susskind, did not have a revolutionary impact. It was largely unnoticed, I would say.
It was poetry. Their work was poetry. They said, it's like a string. If you remember, John, in our papers on loop amplitude, mm-hmm. we had an incredibly complicated analysis of the moduli space of loop amplitude, all orders, which is simply translatable into the moduli space of three-dimensional human surfaces. We had the whole thing in this somewhat convoluted language. But the rest of it was all poetry. You couldn't translate the string theory into these equations. The concept had the equations. When was it?
I'll come to that later. That's around, yeah, right. So anyway, in the bosonic string theory or dual resonance model that I've already told you about, it was useful to think of a momentum density, which integrated to give a total momentum, and then the Virasoro conditions involve the square of this density. So Ramon's idea was, why shouldn't there be a density for the Dirac matrices also? So he said, let's suppose there's a formula like this. And these will have some anti-commutation rules with the delta function, which will give the usual anti-commutation rules for these things. And then the Dirac operator gamma dot p will be some density, and it'll have some Fourier density, and it'll have some Fourier modes Fn, which will be somewhat analogous to the various Fourier modes that you can make, say, of p squared, which give the Virasoro operators. And in particular, if you take the zeroth Fourier mode of this, you get the usual gamma dot p plus the terms, the cross terms from the various oscillator terms in the expansion. So you get gamma dot p plus corrections. So Ramon's idea was very simple. He said there ought to be some analog of the Dirac equation, which is this formula here, where this is some state in the Fock space of all these oscillators, as well as being a spinner and a function of x. And the solutions of this would describe the different states of a free fermionic string. And you could take these operators here and use the canonical commutation rules of these gammas and p's and so on and work out this super Virasoro algebra. The usual for Azur algebra is this bottom line here. And so the addition of the top two lines was Ramon's contribution. To be historically accurate, he didn't write down these constant terms. Neither did Virazzaro in his paper, for that matter. But they were known to most people very quickly. And the interpretation of what these things were was that they were an algebra of subsidiary conditions on physical states, which were necessary to eliminate negative norm states from the spectrum. Actually, in the paper I wrote with Neveu, which I'll tell you about in a moment, we called these subsidiary conditions super gauge constraints. And I believe that's the first usage of the word super in this general setting. So let me tell you what I did with Neveu.
So Nambu was the first to use the word string, is that
right? I think that's correct. So what Neveu and I did was to write down some formulas for bosons which are very similar to Ramon's fermions. The difference was that instead of having a gamma sigma, we had something called an H of sigma, also a Lorentz vector, also with anti-commutation rules. But this H was anti-periodic on a circle. Or you could have an open interval with analogous boundary conditions. And so the Fourier components involve half-integer modes because of the anti-periodicity of the integrand. So there's no zero mode for this G. Anyway, these Gs are just like the Fs in the previous transparency and satisfy an analogous super Virazzaro algebra.
Your motivation for the anti-periodicity was?
Well, we wanted to just invent a new dual resonance model of mesons at first. And when we started doing this, we didn't know about Pierre's work. His work did appear before ours, because his paper was, I believe, in January and ours was in March of 71. We had a wrong paper in February of 71. I don't refer to that, but we had a right one in March of 71. And so...
I mean, wasn't one of the advantages of not having a zero mode is getting rid of the problem? You wanted to get rid of the fact, you wanted to get rid of
it. Yeah. So, that's right. So, when I didn't emphasize it before, but when we implemented these Virazzaro conditions and had intercept 1 for the leading Regi trajectory, that implied that there was a negative mass grade state in the spectrum of what was referred to as a tachyon. And so one goal in trying to construct a new bosonic theory was to get rid of that tachyon. And it turned out, so in certain units, you could say that the tachyon in the previous theory had m squared equal to minus 1. And we did get rid of that state in this construction, but we got a new one at m squared equal to minus a half. So that we view that as a step in the right direction. A few months later, still in the summer of 71, Gervais and Sakita wrote a nice paper where they wrote down a two-dimensional world sheet action. They didn't use those words, but anyway, that's what we would call it today, whose equations of motion would give you these H's and P's and so on. So there's a two-dimensional fermion, which is a space-time Lorentz vector, but it's a world volume spinner. And depending on whether the psi is periodic or anti-periodic, it either describes the H of the work of the Neveu and myself work, or else the gamma of Ramon's construction. And Gervais and Sakita pointed out that this very simple two-dimensional action had this global symmetry. Fermionic symmetry, and certainly that was the first time I've seen explicit supersymmetry transformation formulas in a field theory. It's a free two-dimensional field theory. It's not a very complicated theory, but in any case, there it was. If you're interested in the history of supersymmetry, I could remark that in the Soviet Union, we learned several years later, there was work in early 71 by Golfond and Lichtman, which came at supersymmetry from the point of view of trying to construct the new space-time symmetry in four dimensions that would generalize the Poincaré group to a super Poincaré group.
You would say that this is the first example of supersymmetry.
Well, the Goldfein-Lichtman paper wrote down something that was supposed to be a supersymmetric field theory. And I was never able to figure out, even to this day, which field theory it is. So I don't know whether it's a consistent theory or not.
I once had graduate students check its consistency, and it was perfectly OK.
Yeah. So they found some peculiar supersymmetric theory, not one of the first ones you would learn if you were
called the massive vector, so that was a little unusual. But
yeah.
There was a Dirac theory of four dimensions.
Yeah.
It wasn't a Dirac theory of four dimensions.
Sure, it was interesting.
So it had much more content.
Yeah. Their paper made some peculiar statements, too. They made the remark in their paper that this new symmetry required parity violation.
That was a misunderstanding of Barnes' theory. It's essential to that.
Yeah. So I don't mean to detract from their contribution. They certainly had the idea of a super extension of the Poincaré group. Yeah. And so that was a completely different line of development. Well, we had no such grandiose ideas. We were just trying to do some very pedestrian construction of a new string theory. So anyway, so I told you our paper was in March, and by April or so, Neveu and Thorne and I had wrote another paper where we showed that Pierre's fermions could be made to interact with our bosons in a consistent way. And in 1972, I discovered the need for 10 dimensions by analogy with things that had been done with the other theory to give 26. Also in 1972, there was an important paper by Goldstone, Goddard, Rebbe, and Thorne. And what they did was to take the string picture seriously, formulate a string world sheet action, and explain how to go to what we call the light cone gauge, and do quantization in the light cone gauge. And then they showed that in this gauge that this is a gauge that breaks the manifest Lorentz invariance, and then they showed that in fact the manifest Lorentz invariance is there, but only if the space-time dimension is 26 for the one theory or 10 for the other. And it was quite non-trivial to show that even with these vira zero or super vira zero conditions imposed, that the spectrum really had just positive norm states and no ghosts. And that was proved also in 72. First by Brouwer, and then the work of Goddard and Thorne, and then for the RNS theory, I did it also. And in 72, I moved to Caltech. David stayed in Princeton with Kurt Callan. And when I got to Caltech, I collaborated with a postdoc named Chengqin Wu. And I wanted to, one thing we hadn't computed previously was just fermion-fermion scattering, just the four-particle scattering amplitude and tree approximation. This turned out to be very hard, technically. And at some point, we had to compute the determinant of an infinite matrix. And I could show that in some asymptotic limit, it behaved like 1 minus x to the 1/4. And so I asked Wu to check that on the computer, and he discovered it was exact. And so anyway, we had fun with that. Yeah, it's not a well-known work, but I thought it was nice. Now, I should remark that there were other things going on at the same time. Most notably, the completion and acceptance of the standard model. David got distracted by that. He was better than me in overcoming these prejudices against field theory that had been instilled in us at Berkeley. And so he was able to make significant contributions to this. I didn't have that flexibility, so I just stuck with this stuff. Also in 73 was the Wes-Zumino paper, which and they described what they were doing as trying to find a four-dimensional analog of the two-dimensional supersymmetric theory I showed you. So this development of the Gervais-Sakita description of the world sheet physics of the RNS model was their explicit motivation for constructing a four-dimensional supersymmetric theory, which, as you know, they were very successful at. Now, in any case, not so much because of this, but because of this, string theory very rapidly fell out of favor. We had suddenly a theory of hadrons as well as everything else, basically, and so there was no need for string theory. And string theory wasn't doing so great at describing hadrons anyway. So let me just...
74.
Yeah, so we're still in 73. So 72, 73, people were dropping out like crazy. So there were hundreds of people working on string theory in this 68 to 72 period. It was an active subject. Well, it certainly wasn't as big a community as we have today. Maybe even an order of magnitude, almost an order of magnitude less, but it was quite large. There were very few meetings. People didn't travel as much in those days.
No, I think if you really add it, it's got to be dozens.
Well, look at, there's a Physics Reports issue which puts together five review articles that were written in this period. And there are hundreds of references. So, okay, it was a substantial community, nothing like it is today. And that all disappeared very quickly. Now, let me just remind you why, I'll tell you in a moment about gravity unification, but let me tell you what the problems were interpreting this as a string theory of hadrons. So there were two different models, as I've explained. One of which only had bosons, and the other which had bosons and fermions. But both of them had tachyons. The one with fermions required 10 space-time dimensions, the other required 26. I haven't discussed the spectrum in any detail, but each of them involved massless particles with spins all the way up to 2. Navier and Shirk had shown sometime earlier that the massless spin 1 particles interact like Yang-Mills gauge particles. And in 1974, Joël Shirk, who was employed at the École Normale in Paris, was spending a sabbatical visiting at Caltech, and we were working together. And we decided to look whether there were analogous statements that could be made for the massless spin 2 particles, that just as the spin 1 fields corresponded to Yang-Mills interactions, that maybe these involved gravitational-like interactions. And it wasn't hard to prove that that was true. The hard part was just to ask the question. And Yoneya in Japan did this independently. He also showed that the massless spin 2 particles interact at low energies like gravitons. Now, what Joel and I did, and Yoneya at least didn't stress in his papers, is that we should take this seriously and drop the idea of using strings to describe hadrons, but use strings instead to describe gravity and unification. The reason we could say and unification is because we knew we also had Yang-Mills interactions, and here was a standard model that required Yang-Mills interactions for the other forces. Now, when we were thinking of hadron physics, the Regé slope parameter, remember, corresponded to a hadron scale, 1G, to a hadron scale, 1 GeV minus 2, And now, if we wanted to get these gravitons to interact with Newtonian strength, we had to change the value of this parameter using the Planck scale rather than a GeV scale. And so this meant that the mass scale suddenly jumped by 19 orders of magnitude, or the Regé slope got decreased by a factor of 10 to the 38. So this was a big conceptual step to change the parameter by that amount, even though the mathematics didn't change. No. Yeah, we were enthusiastic about this proposal because we felt it had several advantages. First of all, we had spent several years trying to get rid of this massless spin 2 particle from the spectrum without success. So our conclusion was the theory required it. So having interpreted it as gravity, we could say that string theory required the existence of gravity, And we would contrast that with conventional quantum field theory, which we would state in an extreme way as saying it didn't allow the existence of gravity because it always led to non-renormalizable interactions. We knew that string loop amplitudes had no ultraviolet divergences. So immediately we had a theory that contained gravity and had no ultraviolet divergences. So we thought that was pretty neat. Also, the extra dimensions that had been bugging us all those years no longer looked so bad when we were in the gravitational setting. For a theory of hadrons, there's no sensible thing to say about extra dimensions. But in a theory where geometry is dynamically determined, as it is in a theory of gravity, what's so bad about having extra dimensions? The dynamics could lead to their compactification, as in certain example situations. So, in fact, we saw that we realized that it could give the theory a little more flexibility for incorporating interesting effects. And as I've said, Yang-Mills gauge fields also appeared naturally and could account for the other forces. So we were excited about this, and I decided that's what I'd work on the rest of my life. And it was puzzling to me, and still is, why it took 10 years to convince most other physicists that it's a good idea. Now, in the second half of the 70s, nobody, including myself, did much string theory. And the focus was on supersymmetry and supergravity. There were the famous original papers on supergravity by these people. And also, we were motivated to look at supersymmetric theories in various dimensions. And so in a paper I did with Brink and Shirk, we constructed supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in 10 dimensions, and N equal 4 super Yang-Mills in 4 dimensions. There was related work of Gliazzi, Shirk, and Olive I'll mention in a little while. Also, the maximally extended supergravity theory was constructed by Cremer and Julia around 78. This was an interesting theory. It had a E7 non-compact global symmetry, which came as a surprise. And Cremer, Julian Shirk in, I guess, 79, or still 78, constructed 11-dimensional supergravity, which was also quite a surprise, at least it was to me. And it's a very pretty theory and still very important. During the period 77, 78 or so, I did collaborative work with Lars Brink, Pierre Ramond, and Murray Gell-Mann. All four of us were at Caltech at this time. Ramond was employed there. Brink was visiting. And we were working on superspace supergravity and wrote a few papers on this. And I think it's fair to say that this is the least significant work that any of us ever did. But anyway, we put a lot of effort into it. It just didn't get very far. Let me tell you what Gliazzi, Shirk, and Olive did around 76, 77. They proposed taking the RNS theory that I told you about and truncating the spectrum in a way that would remove roughly half the states, including the tachyon, leaving you with a tachyon pre-spectrum. And then they speculated that after you made, it was easy to see this was a consistent truncation. Incidentally, the reason we were not motivated to consider this truncation back in the early 70s was that the tachyon had just the properties to be interpreted as a pi meson, just had the wrong mass squared. So we viewed it as a pi meson at the wrong mass squared, and the massless vector we viewed as a rho meson at the wrong mass squared, and we tried all those years to shift everything by half a unit. And so it was obvious that we had a property we called G parity, and the pion was G odd. So it was obvious we could have restricted to the even G parity sector in a consistent way, but we weren't motivated to do that because of the hadron interpretation. But Gliazzi, Shirk, and Olive took this step. Right. So now Shirk realized that we weren't doing hadron physics anymore. And so you could contemplate such a truncation. And the speculation was that after you did this truncation, that you had space-time supersymmetry. All that had been established previously was this two-dimensional world sheet supersymmetry, But now one was speculating there would be supersymmetry in the 10-dimensional spacetime. Now, if that were true, a necessary requirement would be that the number of bosonic states should be the same as the number of fermionic states at every mass level. So you count the number of bosonic states at the nth mass level and encode that in a generating function. So d is the number of bosonic states at the nth mass level, and this generating function tells you how many there are. And you do the same thing with the Ramon fermions after the... All the GSO projection does for the fermions is to change what would have been a 16 to an 8 here. Mm-hmm. In this case, it puts in the second term in the half. So now, if there's supersymmetry, this should equal this. And lo and behold, in 1829, Jacopi proved this formula, although he used a different notation. So this implies that at least in the non-interacting theory, the number of bosons and fermions match at every mass level.
These days, of course, people might plot it out numerically, two expressions, to see what it matched. Right?
Well, these guys are better than that. They found Jacobi's work. So, 78-79, I spent a sabbatical year in Paris working with Schirk. Unfortunately, that was his last year of life. He died tragically at the end of the following year. During that year, we worked on using compactification to break supersymmetry. I won't say more about that. And following my stay in Paris, I spent a month at CERN in the summer of 79. At CERN, I happened to cross paths with Michael Green, and we began what was to become a long and exciting collaboration, which lasted for about 6 years. We still talk to each other, but we don't collaborate as intensively now as we did. And so our first goal was to understand better why the GSO projected string theory has space-time supersymmetry. So in these subsequent years, Michael had several extended stays at Caltech where we worked together, and I had an extended stay in London. He was at Queen Mary College in those days. He's now at Cambridge. And we also worked together several summers in Aspen. So we spent probably during those 6 years almost half the time in the same location. During that period, some of our work was also done in collaboration with Lars Brink, also was an important contributor. So some of the things we did was we developed a new light cone gauge formalism for the what we now call the superstring, in which the space-time supersymmetry of the spectrum and of the interactions was easily proved. So that took us about a year to do that. So that appeared in 1980. And we used this formalism to compute various tree and one-loop amplitudes and elucidate their properties. And we formulated and named the type 1, type 2a, and type 2b superstring theories. And we formulated a superstring field theory in the light cone gauge. Hasn't proved to be very useful, at least so far. But in any case, we put a lot of effort into that. And we formulated a covariant world sheet theory with manifest space-time supersymmetry. We couldn't figure out how to quantize it, maintaining the Lorentz invariance. And people are still struggling with that. And then by 82, 83, we began to worry about anomalies. And the issue of anomalies is that when you have theories that are parity violating, as some of the superstring theories are, there's a possibility of having a breaking of the gauge invariance due to quantum corrections, which can make the theory inconsistent. And when that happens, one speaks of anomalies. In the case of 10-dimensional theories like we were dealing with, the anomalies would typically have a structure where you had a classically conserved current which couples to some loop, some particle going around a loop, a chiral fermion, for example, and then there are a bunch of gauge fields attached also. And the problem could be that this that this diagram is divergent, and then when you try to regulate it, you break the gauge invariance, and then in the end, the current is no longer conserved due to this, if there's an anomaly. And the structure of the anomaly is typically given by a formula like this, which represents the non-conservation of the current. So you can see that the number of gauge bosons you attach depends on the dimension of the spacetime, and there are five of these because we're in 10 dimensions. If you were dealing with a four-dimensional theory, there would be two of them. Famous triangle diagrams. Now, this was particularly a problem for the type 1 superstring theory, which is a chiral theory in 10 dimensions and has gauge fields. And the type 1 superstrings were well-defined at tree level as a classical string theory for any orthogonal or symplectic gauge group. But it, one knew that if one just approximated these theories by 10-dimensional Super-Yang-Mills theory, one knew that in that approximation that there were anomalies for every possible group. And so I remember a talk that Paul Frampton gave where he had these big gravestones on one of his transparency, and type 1 superstrings was written on one of the gravestones. And the point was that they were all anomalous. So it appeared unlikely that superstring theory could accommodate parity violation. So that would be bad, since it's clear that if we want to make contact with the real world, that's one feature that the theory ought to be able to accommodate. It was nice to have gravity, but you also needed parity violation. So Michael and I worked off and on this problem for about 2 years until the crucial steps were made in August of 84 when we were in Aspen. I won't describe the details of how the analysis works. I'll just state the conclusion. And the conclusion is that these anomalies can cancel in the n equal 1 or the type 1 superstring theory. More generally, we proved that if you have a theory with one supersymmetry in 10 dimensions and Lorentz invariance, that the anomalies can cancel, but only if the gauge group is either SO32 or E8 times E8. And for any other choice of gauge group, there would be anomalies. So that was exciting because this was the first time to our knowledge that some general principle like this picked out a small number of gauge groups as being better than others from some consistency requirement. And furthermore, it meant that string theory could accommodate parity violation. Well, the only theory we knew how to deal with was SO32 because we had the type 1 theory, which allowed for orthogonal groups, and we had no idea what to make of an E8 times E8, although it wasn't in the first version of our paper, but very shortly thereafter we made a revision where we included the E8 times E8. There's an amusing story. I guess, how am I doing on time? Okay, then I'll tell you my amusing story. So that summer in Aspen, the physicists at the Aspen Center for Physics decided to have a physics cabaret at the Hotel Jerome. And I was asked to play a role that Murray Gell-Mann had played at the previous physics cabaret 10 years earlier. These things used to be held at 10-year intervals, but there hasn't been one since 84, so that pattern has been broken. The role that Gell-Mann had played in 74 was in the middle of the cabaret when someone else was doing a skit, to run up on the front of the stage and then start speaking very loud, saying, "I found a theory that explains everything." and get louder and louder, more and more vociferous about it, and then two other physicists dressed in white coats come up and carry you off the stage. So I was asked, since Murray was unavailable on this occasion, I was asked to play that role. So I got up there and started shouting and screaming about SO32 and anomaly cancellation, and that was the first public announcement. So these results. Yes.
Why did those cabarets stop then?
Well, if you saw one of them, you might understand.
They were organized by Mildred.
Oh, exactly.
I should tell you a skit that Ed Witten played in 1974. Well, I'll tell you privately if you ask me. Okay, so before the end of 84, there were a couple of other major developments. There was the heterotic string by Gross, Harvey, Martinek, and Rome, which accommodated both SO32 and E8 times E8, so that was very important. It completed the list of superstring theories in 10 dimensions, because we had already had three of them, and there are now five, and these were the other two. Of course, we now know they're all the same thing, but anyway, they were five at some point. So that was just a couple months after my work with Michael. And then a month or so after that, there was the famous work of Candelas, Horowitz, Strominger, and Witten, showing that if you compactified 6 of the 10 dimensions on a Calabi-Yau space, that you would be left in 4 dimensions with n equal 1 supersymmetry, and you could get quite realistic gauge groups and multiplets of particles that looked qualitatively like what one needs for some standard grand unified theory. It was never claimed that it was precisely right, but it was very exciting that one came very close to things that were realistic. So at that point, the subject really took off, and very many people joined in. It was amazing, because prior to this, everyone in the world thought the subject was stupider than I did. And then after this, almost everyone thought it was better than I did. Because so many people who jumped in at this point thought we were very close to explaining practically everything. And I was excited too, of course, but I never felt that we were that close. And I think it's pretty clear now that there's still a long way to go. So in any case, but by the beginning of 85, string theory with the goal of unification had become a mainstream activity. And I was hesitating whether I should say the end or the beginning here. So anyway, I'll stop.
Questions and comments? Comments also welcome. Historical comments, questions? I remember going to a conference. Do you remember in Miami? This was in around, must be about 76 or 77. And you were one of the speakers. And most of these talks were on gauge theory, which was very popular at the time. And when you stood up to speak about string theory, I remember half of the audience left the room.
I see.
And then they came back for the next talk. Do you remember that?
Well, I remember speaking on that occasion. I don't remember the people leaving. What I do remember is that Dirac was in the audience.
Right.
And at some point in my talk, I spoke about the Dirac equation in 10 dimensions. And I looked in his direction to see what his reaction would be, and he was sound asleep.
That was the same one I went to. Yeah. In fact, I think it was one of the last conferences that Dirac attended. Questions, comments?
Please. I thought I'd tell you privately. Does this go on the web?
Yes.
I'll tell you privately.
Really, no questions? David, you must have. The other thing that's remarkable is how many of the names you listed had sort of left physics or left string theory.
Well, all these people would be 60-ish now. And, well, you know who the active people who are 60-ish are now. There's Susskind and there's David and Callan and a few others, but not very many.
Like Shapiro?
Well, Joel still works at Rutgers.
So if there are no further questions, let's thank the speaker again.